This is Blueprint for Living. I'm Michael Rowland. Time for Lost and Found. This week, fake. Anything that consoles is fake. Iris Murdoch. Elizabeth Farrelly is an architecture critic, a columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald. Elizabeth, you wrote a book called Blubberland, The Dangers of Happiness. You suggest in that Australia has a particular affinity for kitsch, for fakery. How does that manifest itself in our built environment?
I'm intrigued by this, partly, I suppose, because Australian culture regards itself, I think, as being pretty kind of, you know, close to the ground, authentic. Mm-hmm. And yet I think it's I'm not the first to notice it. You know, Robin Boyd wrote that book,
yes,
The Australian Ugliness, back in the, 60s, I think, commenting on exactly that. And people have actually celebrated it. Lots of artists have loved it. I find it more difficult to love, but I'm intrigued that we Australians are so comfortable with pretense of one kind or another. But in particular in architecture, of course, you get brick veneer and then you get even fake brick veneer. it is really interesting, and it's interesting to speculate on the psychological reasons, I guess, for that.
Brick veneer is even held up as a sort of a sign of suburban solidity.
Exactly. I know. That's really interesting too, isn't it? Because it's, and that comes from that kind of, you know, resistance to termites. We're being very practical here.
Okay.
I think. But you know, because brick veneer sort of sits on a timber frame, and brick, it's using brick as a skin when actually it's meant to be a structural material. It's capable of being a structural material. So it's kind of, I suppose you could argue it either way, but it strikes me as kind of fake.
Is there sort of an aspect of environmental discomfort there for Australians?
Well, I think so. That would be my interpretation. Yeah, I am inclined to think that it comes probably from our kind of still unresolved reluctance to be here properly, fully in this continent and on this place and in this environment. I think we're still uncomfortable with the nature of Australia. You can interpret that however you like. But I think there's a sort of denial, I guess, built into that. And I think that enables us, or perhaps more forcefully than that, impels us to fake things.
It's interesting that we go into those sort of rural structures. And when you think of those, then you start to think of a uniquely post-colonial Australian aesthetic. In the house on the farm, the station house, those sorts of buildings with their broad-brimmed hat roofs, their,
yes,
their big verandas, that's something genuine and real. On the other side of that, we look at sort of suburban building contemporaneously, the sort of the mock Georgian, the strange salutes to European styles that we see in this sort of modern fakery.
It's very interesting. I think even actually in the country, quite often you'll get these beautiful barns. Like the really practical buildings are really beautiful, and the houses which are much more inclined to be pretentious, especially later ones, start faking it. They move into sort of ugliness, in my opinion, quite quickly because of that pretentiousness. So I think the same thing tends to happen in suburbia. It's where we get, it's where we become polite. You know, that the kitsch kicks in, if you like. So it's
interesting.
And I think of, you know, Barry Humphries and Dame Edna and the kind of gladioli culture, if you like, which is all about sort of social climbing and pretending to be more genteel or better bred or better educated or richer than we really are. So it's really when the pretense kicks in, I think, that we do the kitsch.
There's another level of pretense too, in that sort of the ubiquity of the McMansion, something styled on an opulent residence that once would have been set in acres of rolling lawn and now is squeezed into the very boundaries of a fenced suburban block. That's something quite strangely
yeah, you get
fake in that.
Sort of colourbond, the sort of 2 metre colourbond fence all around it, sort of, you know, a hand's breadth from the non-existent eaves. Yeah, and it's It is that. It's that refusal to accept any sort of humility or something, I think, that that makes us move into that kind of kitsch mode of this is actually a mansion when it's clearly not. And it's hard to say whether... I often get into trouble for being judgmental about these things, and people say it's elitist and things. And I'm not sure that that's right. I'm interested in the artists who've celebrated, you know, people like Howard Arkley who've celebrated this stuff, and architects like Peter Corrigan. And I don't agree with them if what they're saying is that it's beautiful. But I can see there's a sort of joy in it. But I also think that in that art itself, it's slightly condescending, because they're sort of saying, well, you know, the people who live in McMansions don't necessarily see them this way, but we're so clever and we can understand their that kind of ironic beauty. So I think it's a very interesting and complex subject, but I think I'm just I'm always resistant to that sense of pretense and of self-aggrandizement that comes with that desire to be seen to be better than you really are.
Are we still looking for a built Australian sincerity? Is that something which will still develop in a young country?
Look, I think so. I think I'm inclined to think that realness, if you like, is something that comes with maturity, with cultural maturity. And I mean, we're probably quite a long way from that. And we're still busy pretending not just to be, probably not to be European anymore so much as to be American, or to be more sophisticated than we are. And I think that the confidence to really be who you are, just as it tends to come fairly late to individuals, it comes fairly late to cultures as well. And it's about being very relaxed with your imperfections, I suppose. That's not easy to achieve. We'll have to either at a personal level or cultural, I suspect.
Have to fake it till we make it.
Well, yeah, that was Aristotle's view. maybe he was right.
Elizabeth, thank you.
That's a pleasure.
Elizabeth Farrelly. Sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. George Burns. Ariel Alayo is curator of a recent exhibition, Faking It, Originals, Copies and Counterfeits, at the Museum of the Fashion Institute of Technology, New York. Ariel, authenticity in fashion, that's a very difficult and contested question.
Well, authenticity in fashion is really quite interesting, because it goes back for, you know, decades and for hundreds of years at that. And it's always interesting because, especially now, I think people are always looking for something that is authentic in fashion. But ever since, you know, the 1700s, 1800s, people already started to imitate things like tortoiseshell or ivory. And people started debating then, you know, is it authentic if you have something that's imitating tortoiseshell, or is it not authentic?
And then, of course, there's the work of designers that becomes, well, both a model for other people, but also a target of counterfeit as well.
Yes, that was actually something that really intrigued me to actually do the exhibition, that I started getting very interested in fashion law and the early legal cases with many designers trying to protect their designs from being copied. And then I got into this rabbit hole of research with licensed copies from designers, and were those pieces authentic or were they not authentic? And it was interesting to see the different public perceptions on, if you were to purchase a Dior licensed copy, was it an authentic piece of fashion or was it a copy?
Because there's a flash of inspiration in a Chanel suit, but then again, it's just a suit.
Yes, very much so. Chanel was interesting in it because at one point she, early on in her career, she actually had some different legal cases with different couturiers where she was very much against copying and had actually won some of the early legal cases. And later on she said, you know, please go ahead and copy me, and she had no problem with it. So it was interesting to see kind of how she had shifted from early on in her career to later on to not actually caring.
Well, and part of that not caring, that's become almost an industry standard with designer diffusion brands, designers pretty much knocking themselves off.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know if I would say that they don't care. I would say it's actually a very strategic move that a lot of the designers do, because instead of having other people copy them and saying, well, I can't afford a Chanel suit, or I can't afford, you know, a designer piece, they really kind of open the market to make it much more accessible to people. So they started doing these lower price kind of bridge brand or diffusion lines, kind of opening it up so where you could still have an authentic designer piece, but it's still affordable.
And of course, in this global culture, it must be almost impossible to police your intellectual property in fashion. I mean, knockoffs are ubiquitous. Knockoffs must vastly outnumber the original on the global scale.
Yes, it's actually quite interesting. I've really been curious with a lot of kind of recent reports on where people are buying counterfeits now. Before, you know, if you were in New York or let's say Los Angeles, you'd buy them on Canal Street or in Santee Alley. But now there's a lot of counterfeits that are being sold through Instagram, through WeChat. And so it's interesting to see that it's going kind of more digital. And with that, it's even more difficult to really police it and to see, you know, who is the person behind, you know, a counterfeit e-commerce store or behind an Instagram account.
Which is not to say that the major designers are blameless in their appropriation of other people's ideas. And this in particular applies in fashion's appropriation of art. I'm thinking of the Mondrian dress, perhaps.
Yes, the Mondrian dress is quite interesting, and there's a really, really great book that kind of goes through all of the different iterations of it from the art historian Nancy J. Troy. But I found it was quite interesting because with the art world, sometimes people care and the original artist, and sometimes they don't care at all. And I had consulted some art attorneys to ask them. I said, you know, with the Mondrian piece or with the Lichtenstein suit, did they care? And they said, you know, sometimes they'll see it as an homage because it's a different medium and it's a different clientele. And sometimes they actually very much do care.
There is an interesting paradox in the play of fashion against appropriation. I mean, inherent in the idea of fashion is imitation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to see. I mean, I always look at a lot of, you know, the things that go down the runway, and I always find, of course, it's completely fine to, you know, take inspiration from something else, but it's always interesting to see is how much do they actually add their own interpretation, or is it just a carbon copy? Recently, there was Christian Louboutin who was speaking about this at FIT, and he had said, you know, when you're designing, that he had his Penzi shoe, and he was inspired by Andy Warhol's flower paintings, but he said it's always super important to sketch out your design, sketch out your inspiration, and when he looked at what he had sketched, he said, this looks like nothing of Warhol's paintings, and that was him really kind of creatively interpreting the painting and then putting it on his shoe.
Ariel, thank you so much.
Great, thank you.
Ariel Alaya.
Change your mind, like a girl, change his clothes.
Fake meat, that's fake news. If you've decided not to eat animals, then the ritual of substitution, why make your vegetable protein into a schnitzel? What's the moral position of someone appalled by bovine infanticide who chooses to eat something soy pressed into the shape of veal? Jackfruit burgers, pepper jerky, the irresistible rise of the 1,001 permutations of misoprotein. What's the implied message about the aesthetic inadequacy of simple plant-based food here? Is the takeout message from shredded soy chicken that we are hardwired for flesh? Well, probably not. Maybe vegan crab cakes are a transitional arrangement, a turning point toward a new way of seeing food. Food that takes away the thing that most cooking with meat delivers, an on-plate hierarchy of taste, a descending sense of culinary significance based on the constant heroic presence of meat. Take away the meat, and anything assuming its position through reassembled protein-based fakery, and you need to see the preparing of food in a new light, a light that intrinsically favours freshness, an even-handed abundance shared between plant, pulse and grain. Fake meat? It's just not real. Gregor Saylor is a photographer in a recent series called Our Eye, called The Potemkin Village. Gregor, to begin, what is a Potemkin village? Where did that expression come from?
Actually, it's a myth, it's a legend, which dates back to the 18th century in Russia. And during that time, Catherine II or Catherine the Great recently conquered the Crimea region. And before she started her a trip to inspect this new conquered area, she sent the Marshal Potemkin to travel through the region and to inspect everything. And he recognized that the condition of the whole region has been a very shabby one. So he tried to hide the original shabby condition while installing backdrops and using colors before Catherine the Great arrived. So it's a legend. The historians still arguing if it is true or not, but the term is still existing and still used nowadays.
And for a photographer, this is clearly an idea that fires your imagination, and you have found examples of this sort of facadist fakery in extraordinary locations.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I started with my research concentrating on this classical meaning. And the aim was to find out if there are existing modern day examples, Potemkin villages constructed due to political reasons, but also if there are existing maybe different reasons why such Potemkin villages are created. Mm-hmm. And well, as I said, I started with the classical meaning. I went back to Russia, where the legend is coming from, and I found two examples in two cities where such Potemkin villages have been constructed due to political reasons, in Sustal and Ufa. So in Sustal, they installed lots of kind of canvas, they masked whole streets and houses to hide the shabby condition due to Putin's visit. And in a larger dimension, this happened in Ufa. It's a town with about 1 million inhabitants in the Ural Mountains, where they masked whole streets, factories, and so on due to an international BRICS summit in 2015. So that was the very first start. And then I went on with my research.
You must have been inspired. Tell us about Swedish Harlem.
Yeah, that's another very, very current example. In southern Sweden, I found two locations where they've been installed to fake cities for testing self-driving cars and safety systems. Hmm. So these examples are not, it's not a film set. It's has been only produced and constructed due to technical reasons. And the result is a very, very surreal one. This Harlem surface in the boreal landscape of northern Europe produces creates a very, very strange, very surreal atmosphere in the pictures.
There is a wonderful surreal beauty in your photographs, this eerie emptiness of these places.
Yeah, well, generally, I'm concentrating more on the tracks and signs of human beings than on human beings themselves. So if you show such places without people in the right light, and the light is very, very important in my works generally, because the light connects the different locations around the world, you're able to increase this surreality and this very lonely atmosphere as well, in context of the surrounding vast landscape, especially in the deserts. And it's very impressive to see which enormous investments are made to create illusions. And that's an aim of the work, to show the sometimes very absurd developments of our society.
Is that proximity to reality, that the thinness of that veneer, is that what gives these locations that sense of eeriness, that sense of slight strangeness?
Yeah, well, I was interested in, on the one hand, showing these illusions and this tightrope walk between illusion and disillusion. So let's take, for instance, the book. So the dramaturgy is playing with this tightrope walk. I construct illusions for the viewer or for the outsider, and then deconstruct them while enabling him a view behind the backdrops. And I think with this approach, it is possible to transport this surreality and this game between illusion and disillusion to the outsider.
Gregor, thank you so very much.
Okay, that's very good.
Gregor Saylor, and the book is The Potemkin Village. The perfect fake plant probably isn't. Kurt Slaw and Brian Trong are founders of Slightly Browning Fake Plants. Kurt, Brian, congratulations on what is a genius endeavor.
Well, thank you so much.
How did you identify this gap in this rather crowded market?
We actually started off a little bit as a joke. We were just looking around at the growing need for people to care for plants, because in urban environments, it's really the only thing you can have. But yeah, we sort of were joking around how fake plants looked a little too fake. They're too green. There's no asymmetries, and that it wasn't real. It didn't speak to us. We came up with Slightly Browning Fake Plants to solve that. Basically, replicas of acceptable quality plants.
You give names to those plants which are sort of descriptive of the sort of conditions that might have led to the slightly browning nature of the plant. Can you tell us some of those product titles?
Yeah, sure thing. Our flagship product is called the 2-Week Vacation. And the big joke there is that this is exactly how your plant would look, as if you had just returned from a 2-week vacation. It's just the perfect amount of browning. It's not too crispy. It's still alive. It's just enough to let everyone know that you do have plants. You are capable of taking care of them, but you also can take a 2-week vacation pretty much whenever you like. So that was one of, I think that's our flagship model. But we have a bunch of others that are in development, or more accurately, they're concepts. And some of our favorites, I think, would be the coder is one of my favorites. And that's someone who is very good at programming and computers. And they've just tried their very hardest to set up a watering system to make sure this plant will stay alive. And unfortunately, there's a bug.
And what did the fake plant manufacturer say to you when you said we want a slightly imperfect fake plant? In fact, one that looks like it might be just a little bit dead.
Well, it took a lot of back and forth, and there was actually quite a bit of confusion originally, and we had to really search through as many manufacturers as we could to even find ones that were set up to like produce plants in this like brown orange tint. But once we found the right manufacturer and clearly got our needs across, they were very easy to work with and very cooperative.
Do your customers approach these products, do you think, with a slightly ironic gaze or in deadly seriousness?
Oh, definitely. I would say that this all started out as a big joke, but then as we were talking about it and pitching it to other people, we found that it was really resonating with people in a weird way. So, you know, if you look on our website, we have a lot of fun with the copy and with all of the creative, because it is sort of this ridiculous product that doesn't quite make sense and doesn't quite fit into a category. But we also have customers who are actually at their wit's end trying to find a fake plant that looks convincing, because it's just such a challenge to achieve from a manufacturing perspective to give it like the texture and look of a real plant. And we sort of take the shortcut with making it look a little browning to achieve
I think you have nailed it. Kurt and Brian, the founders of Slightly Browning Fake Plants. That's great.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production. This week, fake. You heard Ariel Alia, curator of Faking It, Originals, Copies and Counterfeits, an exhibition at the Museum of the Fashion Institute of Technology, New York. Elizabeth Farrelly, architecture critic, columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald, Kurt Slavitska and Brian Trong, founders of Slightly Browning Fake Plants, and Grigor Saylor, photographer. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVissi. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green.